You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiyah. Coming up, a discussion with the Princeton philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah. Born in England and raised in Ghana, Appiah is half Anglo-Saxon and half African. He resists easy classification, but one good word to describe him is cosmopolitan. Another, to borrow Appiah's own term, is contaminated. It's an ugly word, but contamination is what Appiah calls a counter-ideal, a healthier alternative to the dangerous notions of cultural and racial purity, to the borders and fences that divide us. So rather than have us build more walls, Appiah wants us to engage in a global conversation, a mashup of ideas, creeds, and cultures, in the hope that we might get a bit more used to one another. Appiah has recently written a book on the subject. It's called Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers. Anthony Appiah, welcome to ThoughtCast.
Very good to be here.
Anthony, you were first a scholar in philosophical semantics before you turned to philosophy. Why the word contamination?
Well, it's meant to be a bit of a provocation, of course, though it was actually used a long time ago by the Roman playwright Terence to describe his own work, which involved taking Greek plays as models and sort of mixing up the Greek ingredients to make new Roman plays. So he was using the word contamination to defend the idea of borrowing from cultures and remaking things in other cultures. In fact, this positive notion, or this positive spin that Terence put on it, is of course older than the English language, and so it's older than our use of the word contamination.
You've actually written about doing this with words. You've implied that it can be a defensive gesture to take a negative word and appropriate it, turn it into a positive one.
Yes, I think people do this all the time. There are many examples of this, for example, in the sort of badinage of minority groups, where they use a word that other people outside the group use to be rude about them, among themselves, to kind of indicate their closeness. And we can all think of examples of this. I'm not going to utter them, because it's a sensitive matter which ones you're allowed to say. But I think that is something we can do all the time. I mean, I think it's good both to claim words back if you can, but it's also important in thinking about how we use words to recognize that we can harm people with them, and that therefore using the right words when you're talking, especially across differences of various sorts, is a very important thing to try to do.
So how has your use of the word contamination been received?
Well, I think that many people who are in the business of insisting on purity are likely to be upset by someone who says, first, it's a bad idea. Second, anyway, there's no such thing. All the things you think of as authentically something or other turn out to be a mixture. So that, my example in the book is, one of the examples is kente cloth. This thing that everybody thinks of as authentically Asante has to be made out of silk, and the silk had to come from Asia, and it had to be brought by Europeans, and the dyes were developed probably in Europe, and by the late 19th century they would have been the results of the terrific work of German chemists who were the great inventors of dyes in the late 19th century. Those ingredients from elsewhere were of course put together in a distinctive way in Asante. But we couldn't have done it if we had been hostile to the idea of borrowing, if we'd said, oh, we'll never use anything that comes from anywhere else. So I think it's a human thing, again. It's a standard human response to seek a kind of ethnic purity. People do it all the time. I'm just saying it's dangerous. I mean, as we know from the history of the 20th century, it has led to dangerous things. And it presupposes a misunderstanding about how human culture works and what's interesting about human cultures. Venice in the Renaissance, interesting because it's at the crossroads of the world. Athens in the 5th century BC, because it's at the crossroads of the world. London in the 20th century, center of the world. Empire on which the sun never sets, but people kept coming in from all over the place and bringing stuff with them.
Anthony, the subtitle of your new book is Ethics in a World of Strangers. Why do we need a book on ethics now? Haven't we always lived in a world with strangers?
Two important things have changed over the long haul. One is that we're now able to know about everybody, all those strangers. when Diogenes the Cynic, who was the first person to say, I think I'm a citizen of the world, said that, it was a nonsense in a way because he didn't know what the world was. He didn't know about China or about people up the Amazon. And he certainly, and this is the second thing that's changed, couldn't do anything about them. He couldn't affect them in any way at all. Now, not only can we know about other people, both privately by searching through the web, but also increase, of course, by the growth of sort of international media, but also whatever we do is affecting people in other places. If I can choose whether or not to buy fair trade coffee. Every time I don't buy fair trade coffee, I'm affecting the shape of one tiny portion of the world economy, and I'm connected through that decision with coffee farmers around the world. So we're bound to affect other people, and we're electing governments that, like it or not, have to deal with other people. Even the most extreme isolationist in the United States is going to have to accept that her government is going to have to think about trade treaties. So we can affect other people, we do affect other people, and we know what's going on. And that makes a big difference to the context in which we live our lives.
You project in the book that the population of the world will become 9 billion in about 50 years. And perhaps because of this, you say, quote, we need to develop habits of coexistence.
Yes. I mean, we have to share this planet where we're all affecting each other now in these ways, economic. I didn't mention health, but of course, diseases travel around the world all the time, too. We have to live in a world where we affect each other all the time, but we have very different views about how things should be done.
And you think cosmopolitanism can help?
I think cosmopolitanism is the right philosophy for those interactions.
Anthony, in your new book, you are suggesting that parties who disagree, take the U.S. and militant Islam at the moment, two cultures that disagree, get together and converse in so many words. Get to know each other, get used to each other, and as you mention in the book, not necessarily agree.
Yes.
But, as you know, when people speak to somebody with whom they disagree, one confers legitimacy to the other if you give them the chance to be heard. You are saying you have a point worth listening to if you listen. You're already seeding something.
Yes, and it's something that ought to be seeded. And conversation here has to be understood both literally and figuratively. What I'm really interested in urging is a conversation of the civilizations that will involve individual people conversing with other individual people, but it will also involve things like watching movies from Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Indonesia, Morocco. It will involve reading novels from those places in translation. It will involve listening to anthropologists and historians and scholars from these places or about these places, and it will also involve our sending stuff there that aims to explain us.
You're listening to Thoughtcast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Atiyah, and I'm talking with the Princeton philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah about his new book called Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers. You write in your book, quote, loyalties and local allegiances determine more than what we want, they determine who we are. If I look at your allegiances, you're the son of Peggy Appiah, the daughter of Sir Stafford Cripps, the former British Labour Chancellor, and Joe Appiah, a leading lawyer, statesman, and one-time political prisoner. And through him, you're also related to the royal family of Asante in Ghana. You have a PhD from Cambridge. You've taught philosophy at several universities, including Harvard. Now you're at Princeton, and you've been quite open also about your homosexuality. I'm just curious, how much has this background, this part of who you are, influenced and inspired your work, your ideas?
I think it's often quite hard to figure out for yourself what it is in your background that has, you know, made you think about the things you do. But obviously, I have to think about identity in part because I have a kind of unobvious identity in almost anywhere I go. So I grew up in Kumasi, but I was half from somewhere else. And I look different from most people in Kumasi because I'm brown and not dark black. The same when I was at school in England, where most people were white and I was brown. So people, you know, wonder about who you are. if I ask why I sort of think about particularly racial identity and national identity, well, it's because racial identity was a puzzle for me a little bit growing up. Well, not so much a puzzle for me, it was a puzzle for other people. It didn't worry me very much. And because, you know, as far as nationality goes, I was born in England. I was born a British citizen. I actually was a British citizen while I was growing up in Ghana. And I'm now an American citizen. And so, you know, I think it's bound to affect your sense of these questions. And I think it's good for someone like myself who has access to stories, as it were, about the ways in which identities can be complicated and nevertheless perfectly satisfactory. I think that is a resource which I, as it were, have to offer to this discussion.
Your complicated story of identity and race and nationality, belonging, so to speak, has this hurt you? Do you feel that you are and have been an outsider?
I think the thing, as I say, that sort of kept me from ever feeling like that is having a very solid sense of a family. So,
but surely bouncing back and forth between England when you were growing up and Kumasi, you went to boarding school in England, you visited your grandmother, as you said, must have been a challenge on these issues.
Well, so everybody always told us, but I have to say that it didn't seem all that challenging to us. We were well protected. I mean, if I think about what the one word explanation for why it was easier for us, I would have to say class. I mean, we were from on both sides. My family came from relatively elite backgrounds, and that gave them a kind of confidence and security, I suppose, that they were able to transmit to us. So the challenge of movement is much harder if you're poor or you feel powerless or unconnected. When I went to England, I wasn't like the average Ghanaian going to England, someone who couldn't, for example, find a lawyer if he got into trouble. My uncle was a lawyer. My cousin was a judge at the Old Bailey. So, you know, these things make life easier. They make you more relaxed in a place. And in the United States, where I don't have that, you know, I have my friends, and also I have the position that you have as a professor at a university. I mean, you're protected by an institution there. So
it's this elite background, though, this issue of class, that makes me wonder how you might be able to discuss in your work these issues of race and identity and group membership, when you don't really, to be honest, I'm assuming, understand what it would be like to be African American here, to grow up in a world where you are discriminated against. It sounds like you have been protected. Mm. How can you speak on these issues when you really are, in some ways, an outsider to these issues?
Well, the whole point of sort of cosmopolitan conversation is to try and understand what it's like to see the world from all kinds of social positions, all kinds of places and angles and religious points of view and experiences of sexuality and so on. So what entitles me to talk about, say, the African-American experience is just that I've studied it and that I've talked to people and that I've tried to make sense of it, that I've been a professor of Afro-American studies for 20 years. It's very important, I think, that people speak about identities both from within and from without them, because it's that dialogue between how it looks from the inside and how it looks from the outside that is the cosmopolitan dialogue, that is the dialogue, the conversation that I'm urging. And it's a very important thing to remember that you can learn a great deal about yourself by seeing how others see you. And there's a famous poem of Robert Burns's. It's a poem that says, you know, it would be great if we could have the power to see ourselves as others see us.
It's scary,
but important. And we know this in American history. Many people would say that if you wanted to read one book to understand the kind of core of America in the 19th century, perhaps even still, it would be by Tocqueville, who wasn't an American at all. So I think that we need, obviously, to listen to people speaking from the position. How the world looks from their point of view is a crucial thing to bear in mind. But people don't own the discourse about themselves, nor do they always know the truth about themselves. They can have their view of themselves corrected. So when someone says, you may not speak about us. Again, I say, why? I mean, I have the right to speak and think about what I want to speak and think about. If you don't want to talk to me, that's your choice. Conversation requires two parties to occur at all. It requires a certain kind of openness on both sides to be profitable. And in my view, the key thing about the reason why the metaphor of conversation is a good metaphor for thinking about relations across cultures is that in conversation, you are not aiming at producing any particular result in the other person. Conversation is not evangelism. People argue in conversations and they try and persuade each other of things, but the pleasure of conversation isn't instrumental. The point of conversation is to... human beings like to converse. There's a cross-cultural universal.
You're listening to Thoughtcast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Atiya, and I'm talking with the Princeton philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah about his new book called Cosmopolitanism: Ethics in a World of Strangers. Anthony, you're well known from your previous work as being a skeptic of the politics of identity, Afrocentrism, even about the concept of race, which you argue is a fabrication, not a fact. And I'm curious how these views have been received by some of your colleagues. You have worked, for example, at Harvard, and Skip Gates is a good friend of yours. You've co-edited books together. He is the Department of Africa and African American Studies chair at Harvard. What is his reaction to your distance from some of the issues that are so key to blacks in America?
Well, I think you should distinguish between challenging claims made about the nature of an identity and challenging the identity itself. I have no... it seems to me that it's sort of up to you how important you allow various forms of identity to be in your life. I think that an African American who doesn't want to make her being African American very important to herself has the right to do so, but that isn't the choice that most African Americans make, and of course there are contexts in which you have no choice at all because people are going to respond to you as a black person whether you like it or not. All of that, I think, should sort of be taken for granted. Nevertheless, if people make factual claims about the character of an identity, for example, that it's grounded in racial biology, then it's the task of scholarship to examine those claims and decide whether they're correct. Now, all forms of significant forms of identity tend to come with beliefs, some of which are false and many of which are wildly false. This is true about gender identities. People have the most astonishingly mistaken ideas about the relationship between sex and what people can do. People have, many Americans have a very distorted understanding of the role the United States has played in the world in its history, even in its recent history. Most Americans don't think of this country as one that has destabilized governments in many continents, that has replaced regimes, that has undermined the stability and security of many countries. But those are facts. And if an American says, in defense of her identity as an American, you know, we're a good country, I'm inclined to say, not sure what that means, but when people think badly of the United States, here's what they're responding to. So, you know, in the case of racial identities, people have these views about how biology figures into it, and the views are widely agreed by the relevant experts to be mistaken.
But when another colleague of yours at Princeton now, Cornel West, writes a book called Race Matters, that's a different use of the word race from the biological.
Yeah, he's talking about what I call racial identity, not race. He's talking about these social identities that are constructed around stories about what people suppose to be inherited in the body. Racial identity is something you get from the racial identity of your parents. And many people think of that transmission as being not cultural but biological. But the fact that people think of themselves as belonging together as African Americans and the fact that other people think of people belonging together as African Americans, those are facts.
However, you're uncomfortable with some of these groups and what they can do. In your previous book, The Ethics of Identity, you talk a great deal about this. You basically say that these group identities, like African Americans or WASPs or environmentalists, can end up just having one tyranny replaced by the next.
Yes. Well, I think that one of the things I said in that book towards the beginning is it would be absurd to be either for identity or against it. That would be like being for or against gravity. It's there. In human social life, identities matter. And they can be used for good or evil. The guiding sort of ethical thought of my work on this topic has to do with the idea that John Stuart Mill really introduced into Western philosophy, at least in this formulation, the idea of individuality, the idea that each of us is entitled to be in command of his or her own life. And one of the things that people do with identities is create their individuality, create the mechanism by which they manage their own life. To the extent that an identity is an instrument in that process, it's a good thing if you believe in individuality. To the extent that some people experience it as stultifying, as limiting their capacity, it's a bad thing. What we have to try and do, I think, is to create a world in which most of the identities, I suppose ideally all of them, have the property that for most people they're usable in positive ways for the construction of their lives, and that where people find them an obstacle to the construction of their lives, there's a way for them to be released from those identities.
So if we look at a particular identity, say environmentalism, the tyranny there is that everybody who's an environmentalist, who's a member of that group, must conform to the rules of that group.
Yes. Identities have what I've sometimes called norms of identification. That is, there are things that people take it that if you're a member of that group, you ought to do. And the ought isn't a grand moral ought, it's just the regular ought. Men ought not to wear dresses.
But it's policed by these groups.
It's policed by the groups themselves. It's policed by outsiders as well. It isn't just insiders who police these things. The norms of identification for black people under apartheid were enforced largely by white policemen and white authorities. So there are these notions of how people ought to behave, and they can be positive in someone's life. I have a Jewish identity. Suppose I have a Jewish identity and I think of myself as Jewish, and one of the norms of that identity is that I should do positive things for the Jewish community. I do those positive things. It's good for the community. I feel uplifted by it. Where's the harm in that? Where's the harm in that? It's when somebody says to me in a political argument, well, you're a Jew, so you ought to support the Israeli government, that I say, well, their identity is being used to bash somebody over the head rather than to directly confront what in that case is the issue, which is, you know, is the government of Israel doing what this person thinks a government ought to do?
You've written also a bit about the gay identity. Mm-hmm. How does this group identity limit someone? You're gay. Do you feel this is a struggle in your life?
I haven't particularly found that identity limiting, and in fact, I think that for many people of my generation in the West, and increasingly outside the West, it's been a useful form of identity because it's contested a much more negative sense of what homosexuality is, which has been the dominant sense in many societies, not all, but in many. But I notice, and I am happy, that there are many younger lesbian and gay women and men now who think that the form of gay identity that it was developed after sort of the Stonewall riots and so on in New York required a set of ways of behaving for gay people, created a set of norms of identification that don't suit the way these people want to live, these young people want to live. And I, you know, my view is that's up to them. And I think it's a sign of progress, actually, that they feel that homophobia is so much less of a threat than it was to the generations before, that they can feel that it isn't, as it were, necessary to band together as a kind of derogated group, but rather it's possible to acknowledge a sexual orientation and sexual preference for members of one's own gender without thinking that, that much else follows from that about how one should live, and also without thinking that one has any particular obligations to other people who have that preference. So these are choices people have to make. I think it's fine that they make them. There will be contest about this. People will say, you ought to be doing such and such because you're gay, or you ought to be doing such and such because you're black. And all I want to say is that that's okay too. It's fine to engage in dialogue about these things, but at a certain point it can become oppressive.
Anthony, I'm sure you're aware that you are the ideal embodiment of this cosmopolitanism that you write about and that you endorse. It could seem like a rather self-serving philosophy.
Well, it certainly suits me and suits my life. One of the things I do say in the book, though, in which I believe, is that part of being a cosmopolitan, one of the things a cosmopolitan who respects difference endorses, is, among other things, the freedom not to be cosmopolitan. I'm endorsing cosmopolitanism as a picture of one, I think, valuable way to be. I'm not endorsing it as the only valuable way to be. I don't know how one would decide that something was the only valuable way to be. And indeed, part of the difference between the cosmopolitan and other kinds of universalists is that we're much more skeptical than they are about our own claims. We're more aware of our own fallibility, of the fact that we might be wrong about things. One of the reasons why we want to talk to other people is because we think we might learn from them. It's not that we want to change them, it's that they might be able to change us.
You're listening to Kwame Anthony Appiah, the Princeton University philosopher, talk about his new book called Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers. And this is ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia. Let's get to a specific example of how you, Anthony, are living your own philosophy. In your earlier book, In My Father's House, for example, which was published in 1992, a while ago, you tell the story of your father's funeral in Ghana and the clash of cultures that developed from it, modernity versus tribal custom versus tradition. Can you set the scene?
Yes. So my father died after a long illness, and he was not on very good terms during that illness with his sister, my Aunt Victoria, who was married to the late King of Asante, whom I knew growing up as my Uncle Matthew, but he became Otumfuo Pukuwari II. And these are big social occasions, and they are the way in which people sort of create, you know, and sustain what the political scientists would call the social capital of Asante. And they're characteristically managed by the matri clan, by the mother maternal lineage of the dead person. So in my father's case, this would have been natural for his sister to take this on. And so now, unfortunately, because my father was having a row with his sister about what, I have no idea, he chose to write a codicil to his will while he was ill, which he insisted on recording in the High Court in the capital, which said that he wanted his funeral to be conducted by his wife and children, which was extremely irregular. And not only was it irregular, it implied some sort of lack of happiness about his relationship with his matri clan.
A slap in the face.
So it was a slap in the face to the wife of the King of Asante in a funeral that was going to happen in his capital. So.
And your father was an extremely important man, let's face it.
My dad was an important person there. He was, not only was he the brother-in-law of the king, but he was also, as I say, the nephew of the last one, and he had actually been very much involved in the process that had led to the selection of the last king as king, because there's competition among different royals for this position, and my father had been involved in getting the job, as it were, for my uncle. So anyway, so it was a big deal, and everybody was gossiping about it madly, and I'm afraid that not having lived in Ghana as an adult a great deal, sort of just thought, well, my job is to do what my father wanted. And that meant, you know, organizing a funeral without the help of the Abusia, is the word, of the maternal family. Well, it was very important, in order not to allow this sort of insult to continue, for them to try and recapture control of the thing, which they did in obvious ways. I mean, they tried to get his church, where we were going to have the ceremony, to make us, you know, do the right thing, as far as they were concerned.
They practiced witchcraft?
So it is alleged. we were certainly told that various sort of curses have been put on us, and my sister insisted on doing what you do to counter these curses, which is to slaughter a white goat with the help of a Muslim ritual specialist.
Well, let me read a few paragraphs, abbreviated paragraphs from your book at this point. You and your sisters have been summoned to the palace of the king, and you know that you're going to be discussing this matter further under some duress. You fear your aunt is going to make things very difficult for you there. You write, "We faced the prospect of a funeral delayed for weeks by my aunt while she made efforts to undo the effects of my father's codicil. As this spectacle continued, my sisters and I grew angry. Their murmuring in my ear became increasingly urgent. Finally, when indignation had turned into the unfamiliar emotion of rage, when the blood was pounding through my head, I could not take any more. This wrangling over my father's corpse, as it struck me, was more than I could bear. I could not restrain myself. I stood up and walked to the edge of the rug nearest the door, with my sisters gathered around me before I spoke. Quote, "Everybody here knows what is going on, and my sisters and I are not going to sit here and let it happen. We were not going to be party to such an abuse of the stool. We were leaving." By now, my sisters were all in tears, shouting too at them, "Why are you doing this to us?" Pandemonium broke out. Never, they told us later, in the history of the court, had anyone walked out on the king.
And that, for all I know, that's true. But, you know, we were, as you can imagine, rather upset. So people often get upset around funerals, in Asante as elsewhere. And so from the point of view of sort of our tradition, the important thing was not to let that rupture continue indefinitely. And so it was very important to once they realized we were angry, it was very important for them to bring us back in. Somebody apologized on our behalf, and then the king said, "This is finished," meaning nobody should talk about this ever again.
Let me actually quote what you have here on that. You mentioned that he says, "Of course, we should beat him with rods of iron until he bleeds," that would be you. "But then," he added after a masterful pause, "he is our child and we would only have to tend his wounds."
Yes. Well, that's a very characteristic, Asante, characteristic Asante rhetorical expression. I mean, the guy who said that was a brilliant orator in our tradition, and he knew how to use proverbs and formulas like that in order to calm things down. I mean, so nobody was actually planning to beat anybody up, but that was a way of saying this is a very serious offense. And then the sort of second half of it is a way of saying, but he belongs to us and we have to, well, they belong to us, my sisters and I.
The reason why I raise this story is that, first of all, you behave in an uncharacteristic fashion, as you mentioned.
Yes.
I think it's the only time I'm aware of that you ever have behaved in a possibly unreasonable fashion. That's something we could debate. But I'm looking at this from the perspective of your book. You walked out on the king. You were not engaging in conversation. You were terminating it.
Yes. Well, I think, I mean, in that context, that was turned out the strategic thing to do, because it was the only way to indicate how upset we were and to express our sense of what was going on. But, you know, and if I had been, nobody's prepared for the death of their father, but if I had been more prepared, perhaps I would have been able to manage it in some other way. But, you know, conversation does require sort of two parties, and it does require a kind of commitment of a certain kind of genuine openness to sort of hear and be heard. And what this was a charade organized in order to coerce us into agreeing to something that we weren't inclined to agree to. And so it wasn't really a conversation. it was a sort of complicated performance, an exercise of power.
But isn't that what most relationships can be, when, especially if there's some principle or issue at stake?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what your book is really, frankly, facing, are
yes.
issues of power.
Yes. We have to figure out how to create conversation. And that means conversation that is something that you do with friends, with people with whom you're on some kind of terms of equality. And it's very hard to do with people who aren't friends or people who are either very much higher than you in some system of power or very much lower than you. But if we want to understand one another, we are going to have to talk to one another as if we were equals, even if we don't believe we are. And that means, as I say, above all else, I think, two things: listening as well as talking, and not having an agenda in terms of what the outcome will be, not wanting to get the other person round to any particular point of view.
You're listening to Thoughtcast. I'm Jenny Atiyah, and I'm talking with the Princeton philosopher Anthony Appiah. You are a highly reasonable person. You believe in reason. You're a philosopher. And now you've written this book on cosmopolitanism. You're suggesting that we think about adapting this way of behaving. Do you feel that you practice what you preach?
I should say that when I say I believe in reason, I think that what I mean is I think that's the way to work things out, to figure out what the truth is. It's the only shot we have, as it were. But what I don't believe is that logical argument is the way in which people come to get along. And I don't believe that even powerfully persuasive logical argument is going to make other people change their mind. I know this from long experience, but I also know it because my mother told me this when I was a child, and or a young man, actually. I mean, a teenager. She used to say to me, when I was sort of arguing with her in my annoying way, she said, you know, you're exactly like your grandfather, Stafford. I mean, she didn't call him Stafford, but her dad, who was a very, very smart man, the highest paid lawyer in England, very clever, constantly beating people in arguments. And she's this is my mother talking, and they would go away, not convinced, but just wondering what had hit them. So my mother said, don't think because you win these logical arguments that you're persuading people. Don't think that they agree with you, because they go away with a puzzled look on their face wondering why they lost the argument. So I've sort of been, you know, I was warned as a young person that this isn't the way you persuade people. And so it's not enough to be sure that you're right. The other person may well be sure that he or she is right too. And you still have to live together. And you still have to live together without it's being certain that you can come to an agreement between you about what the truth is. All that's very important, I think. I do think, however, that there's another notion of reasonableness, which is a willingness to engage with other people, to listen, to compromise, very different from the philosopher's notion of reasonableness, which I do believe in. It's a sort of practice of attention to others and a willingness to explain yourself, where the point is just to be understood, not to convert, and so on. I think all of this is useful. And actually, one of the things that I do think I got very much from my father's family traditions is a preoccupation, actually, with a kind of, as it were, courtesy in exchanges. And if there's one thing in the world that does make me mad, it's not actually wickedness, which just makes me want to do something to stop it. It's bad manners, which makes me very cross. If you want to make me angry, you know, displays of discourtesy is the way to go. Because I just come from a place where you don't do that, and I find it very hard to.
Well, perhaps you
handle.
Find journalists a little on the discourteous side on occasion.
No, I think anyway, American journalists tend to be, if anything, a bit too polite.
Well, last question for you. In your book, you remind us that, quote, philosophers rarely write useful books. Do you think that your book is not a useful one?
I think that what I meant by that is that philosophers are characteristically preoccupied with getting it right. But as I just said, getting it right is not what you need to focus on when you're trying to rub along, get along with people. There, what you need is to get used to one another. And what I tried to do in the book was not to insist on being right about all the philosophical things, but to suggest rather a picture of a way of going on which could be recommended to people who had very different philosophical views, could be recommended to Muslims and Christians and Jews and atheists, could be recommended to people on the political left and people on the political right, and so on. And in that sense, I hope it is useful, because it's in that way rather unphilosophical. I use the philosopher's tools to sort of disentangle questions, but it isn't with the characteristic philosophical aim, which is just to get it right, just to get all the all the all the whole picture right, the epistemology right, the metaphysics right, the ethics right. It's rather in the service of, as I say, suggesting a way of interacting, which I think is both rewarding and also potentially can help us escape from some of the great challenges of conflict in the world today.
And potentially fun.
Yes, the key thing about cross-cultural encounters engaged in the right way and cross-identity encounters within societies engaged in the right way is that they can be just very entertaining. And since we are in a world that's relatively full of diversity at the local level now, human diversity isn't sort of clumps of different people all over the place, but it's places like New York and Mumbai and Mexico City, which are full of people from all over the place. This kind of interaction is extremely difficult to avoid. And if it's difficult to avoid, why not approach it as something in a way that'll make it enjoyable?
Kwame Anthony Appiah, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Kwame Anthony Appiah is a philosopher at Princeton University and author most recently of Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers. His earlier works include The Ethics of Identity, Thinking It Through, An Introduction to Contemporary Philosophy, and In My Father's House, Africa in the Philosophy of Culture. And this is ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiyah. Thanks for joining us.